Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people who both bring more native intelligence to the sorts of issues that we care about here at Secure Freedom Radio and who have better credentials for talking about intelligence in the technical sense of the word than does our first guest. His name is Pete Hoekstra. He has a number of titles, all of which are of considerable esteem. He served in the United States Congress for quite some time, including as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He also has been our ambassador to the Netherlands during the Trump years. And these days, we're very pleased to say, he is the chairman of the advisory board of the Center for Security Policy. He's a great friend of this program and of me personally, and I'm always delighted to have a chance to visit with him, especially at some length. Congressman, Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Chairman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
As Pete, it is always great to be back with you, Frank.
That simplifies things. I am defaulting to your grace as another alternative. So let me start with you by just trying to sort of do an update, if you would, on the nature of what has gone down in Afghanistan, now a few weeks after the United States military finally left lock, stock, and barrel, or with a lot of equipment actually left behind as well. How do you see things there now, Congressman, and how does it portend difficulties for us with the global Islamic movement, of which the Taliban is, of course, now a leading element?
Well, Frank, Afghanistan and the withdrawal was a huge disappointment and a huge failure on America's part. The Taliban is back in control. You know, we don't hear much about it anymore, but, you know, there's Americans that are still there trying to get out. There are probably thousands of people, Afghans, who worked with the U.S. military, who worked with the State Department, and other U.S. agencies who are at risk. They were left behind. And, you know, so that's one. We left people behind whose lives are in danger. The second thing is it's the Taliban is in control. And as much as the Biden administration likes to say, well, you know, this may be a new Taliban. You know, they've worked with us in good faith. No, excuse me. They are the Taliban. They will provide a safe haven for Al Qaeda and other radical jihadist movements, where they can again plan and prepare to attack the United States of America, Europe, and and other parts of the globe. And it's nothing good came out of this. We had the terrible they said, well, hey, if it becomes a haven, we're going to have this over the horizon capability to go after Al Qaeda, to go after this ISIS-K unit. And it's kind of like, you know, over the horizon only works if there is something there over the horizon to tell you what is over the horizon. And, you know, you can do signals intelligence and overhead and all of these types of things. But the bottom line is you need some human capability. You need human intelligence. You need spies. You need people who are willing to, who are on the ground, who are going to give you information. And as what we found out with the tragic strike, as we were still withdrawing, that intelligence is gone. Why would anybody in Afghanistan stick their neck out today to help the United States with intelligence as they see others who have done that being killed by the Taliban in other groups?
Congressman, I was interested in something you said a moment ago. You talked about it being a failure. As you may have seen last night, Laura Logan was on Tucker Carlson's show, and she said, you know, it's not really a failure. This was what was intended. What do you make of the concern that I think Laura and, well, frankly, I, and I think quite a number of us feel that there's something worse going on here than just incompetence or failing. There is a malevolent intent, seemingly, operating that explains far better the magnitude of this disaster. I mean, it's hard to imagine that just incompetence could be at work when it's so comprehensive and so devastating. No?
Yeah, well, Frank, for, you know, failure is in the eye of the beholder. And I think as you and I would look at Afghanistan, we would say that the circumstances that we are in now versus a month ago or 3 months ago or whatever clearly is a failure of U.S. foreign policy. Now, you know, it may not look that way to President Biden and his team of advisors. These are the same people that embraced the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and oversaw the overthrow of Mubarak. These are the same
and Gaddafi,
people that
and in Tunisia.
And, yeah, I was going to say
in Syria.
They embraced the radical jihadist in Libya, overthrew Gaddafi, and then led to the formation of ISIS in Syria. And so for them, it's kind of, and as we've watched the language, well, you know, we might be able to work with the Taliban. You know, there's a possibility that we will recognize them. There's a possibility we will give them humanitarian aid. So I think you're right. They maybe don't see this as a failure. And that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we can't police all these people. And actually, we can work with them. It's very much the European approach. if we can all just sit down together at the table, we can get along.
I've confessed that I've come to the conclusion it's more of a Marxist approach to, you know, the worse the better for the United States. It's a kind of wrecking operation, in my view. But this brings me to, you know, one of the nations that has clearly benefited most, you know, the old Ki Bono line, China. The Chinese Communist Party has come out of this strategic defeat for the United States, it seems, as has, I think, the global Islamic movement, not only a relatively stronger, seemed to be a rising power, but also emboldened by what has happened by the hands of the Biden team. Give us your sense as a former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Pete, as to where things stand now with China and what you think may be in the offing, perhaps for Taiwan, perhaps for our other interests in the Western Pacific, or perhaps even for us as well.
I think China believes that they've, you know, the world is in their hands right now, at least, you know, Asia, in that they see a weak America. You know, some, hey, we were beat by the Taliban. Give me a break. You know, and then we left. They have treated John Kerry really with disdain as he's over there trying to negotiate and convince the Chinese that they really ought to embrace climate change. And as they were meeting with, as the Chinese leadership was meeting with the Taliban leadership, John Kerry was in China and he was getting a few Zoom calls with the second tier of leadership. They don't respect us. They don't fear us at this point. And, you know, I'm trying to make a list of all of their sins. All right. The Uyghurs, organ harvesting, Hong Kong. And you just continue down, you know, economic terrorism against the West. You just go down the list. Before, and then you get to, oh, by the way, they weaponized COVID, which I firmly believe. And so they, you know, if they're ever thinking of going into Taiwan, which we know they are, I would guess that they see that their opportunity to do that is with this administration. I've got people, sources who have told me that not only did, you know, our Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Chairman Miley, not only did he say, I'll call you if we're going to attack. Some of my sources have told me that in the conversations that General Miley had with his counterpart in the Chinese Communist Party was, if you invade Taiwan, we will not do anything.
That's a whole nother level of betrayal than what we've been reading about in.
Yes, it is.
And Costa's book.
And I can tell you that this source sometimes is out there a little ways. But I can tell you that, and I'm working on a book on this. He told me a lot about the COVID pandemic. He's got sources that, you know, have been feeding him information for the last 18 months. And stuff that he was saying, you know, a year ago that, you know, you were saying, God, that's a different narrative than what I'm getting from the mainstream media and all of that, or from our own intelligence community, now is proving to be very, very accurate. So, but these are the kinds of questions that the Senate has to ask Miley. You know, it's obvious he talked with him. It's obvious
he's
undermined our president.
No,
but what else did he say?
Yeah, yeah, agreed. Let me come back if I can, and I don't want to scoop your upcoming book on the subject, which will be fascinating.
But my book is a way out, so yeah, okay. Don't worry about it.
All right, but on this question of weaponization, what do you mean by that? Is this the fact that they genetically engineered it in a bioweapons laboratory, or is it that whatever was going on there when it inadvertently leaked out, they seized upon it to sort of run a, well, proof of concept of some of their biological weapons plans, or something else?
No, I think that it accidentally leaked. I don't believe they intentionally leaked it. I believe that it accidentally leaked from a laboratory, and that when they saw that it had escaped, they said, "Wow!" You know, they had multiple paths they could take, but the two obvious were they could engage with the international community and try to get a lid on this thing as quickly as possible. They didn't do that. Okay. What they did is they recognized either a proof of concept or saying, you know, the release of this thing internationally will help us achieve our political, economic, and military goals. It will shorten our time horizon to get to our stated objectives. And so they then weaponized it. I believe they put together a huge disinformation campaign, take a look at what they did with the WHO and those types of things. And ultimately, they also saw it as a tool to get rid of Donald Trump. And so, you know, that's what I mean by weaponized, that once it got out there, they said, we can use this to our benefit. And they did.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch this develop further over the next few months. As you say, what seemed to be out there just a few months ago is very much now the bare minimum. And I think, frankly, that's the case with this idea that they were, seizing upon an accident. I think it may well prove that they did this with foreknowledge, and it's, yes, part of a proof of concept of their larger ambitions with respect to biological warfare against the United States. We'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, former Congressman
Frank, what we need to acknowledge is this is an evil regime. Look at what they do to their own people.
Absolutely. No, you're so right. And by the way, you mentioned the Uyghurs, who they don't really consider to be their own people. But what you're saying is so true of how they treat even Han Chinese, with their social credit system and other techniques of repression, to say nothing of those like the Falun Gong that, you know, they organ harvest and the like. But this brings me to a larger question, sir, because you alluded to this a moment ago, that they may feel this moment with this particular team in power in Washington, that they have an opportunity to act against Taiwan, or against our interests, or even maybe against us. There is something about this that I would like just to have you comment on, if you would, and that is the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party knows that it has deeply compromised the President of the United States. And for that matter, I think it's pretty demonstrable that quite a number of his senior subordinates have similarly been compromised by the Chinese. Either they've been paid, or they've done work for them, or they've been aligned with them at a minimum and helpful to them in influence operations and the like. And that includes you know, to my way of thinking, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Bill Burns. But talk about the extent to which you've really lived this intelligence community work and overseeing it. How important a factor would that kind of calculation be in the decision-making of the Chinese Communist Party as to how it might try to take advantage of the present moment?
Oh, I think it's a significant part. They've got information and relationships with these people that at any point, I think they realize, but more importantly, the people that they've had these relationships with over years know that they could be compromised very, very quickly at a drop of a hat. And, you know, it's scary. So it's not about how the Chinese will respond as much as the Americans who are establishing our foreign policy and our direction to China. How much will it influence their decision making as to how we will treat China, knowing, you know, that they full well, they know the depth of the relationship and how much they personally could be compromised.
Exploiting all of that is part of the art form of the Chinese Communist Party. Let me turn quickly and lastly with you, if I could, former Congressman Pete Hoekstrom, Ambassador the United States to the Netherlands. You will be watching closely, I know, as will many of us, the performance that will be taking place as we speak in the near future of Joe Biden, the President of the United States, on the world stage, as they say, at the United Nations General Assembly. He is widely expected to use the speech to trumpet both the need for collaboration internationally on COVID, but also on climate change. And I'd be very interested in your thoughts. Of course, by the time this program airs, we'll know exactly what he said. But the contempt that the Chinese have for John Kerry is palpable. The UN General Secretary said the other day that, the Chinese have made it clear they're not interested in cooperating with us on anything, climate change included. But what's this all about, really? You represented us in a country that literally lives and dies by sea level, in those lowlands. But what are your thoughts on the truth about, man-caused conditions that are making the world less habitable and therefore must be urgently, altered, perhaps at horrific expense in terms of, our economy or even our society?
Well, it is, they're using climate change, or climate change is being used by the left to, reimagine our economies. And under Donald Trump, we had the opportunity, we addressed issues with climate change. We did it through market dynamics and those types of things. But here, what we're now finding is, we will remake our economy drastically. We will probably continue to lead the world in addressing these kinds of issues. But we won't do it with market dynamics, and we will put American jobs and the American economy at risk. And most importantly, China will not cooperate, or they will not embrace the same kinds of standards that us and the Europeans will. And we will continue to let them take advantage of our economies, of our workers, and they will laugh all the way to the bank, and they will laugh all the way to their growing influence in the world. And, I'm watching the Dutch had an election back in March. They still haven't formed a government. But, they're one of their big debates is exactly how much more money are they going to spend on climate change? And as far as I can tell, watching from here, they're not spending any time talking about how they increase their level of spending on defense and national security to the agreed upon 2% for NATO. And so they'll spend $6 billion on climate change. And my guess is they'll spend There'll be a small increase, if any, on defense, because I think if they came and said, President Biden, we're spending $6 billion on climate change, which is a big number for the Dutch. Therefore, we're not going to be able to spend any more on defense, and we're going to stay at 1.2%. We're going to stay at a level which puts them in the bottom four or five countries for spending on defense. And this administration will say, thank you. Thank you. That's fine. We have no issues. We have no problems with that. It will go on to, if you want to put Huawei into your telecommunication system, that's okay. But, as long as you're spending, no problem. We're not even 25% into this administration. The time that they're going to be in office, we're close to what, 20%? I'm scared of what this administration can do in 4 years.
What they've done so far is scary enough, let alone what can be projected based on what they've got in train at the moment. And especially, and I appreciate so much your clarity on this point, Pete, from your various vantage points, the degree to which our adversaries are taking great heart from all of this, are being inspired, encouraged, enriched, and emboldened is really frightening. And we've lived in dangerous times.
Let me give you one more example very quickly. 20th commemoration of 9/11. Not one mention of the threat from radical Islam. That is, you can't go there. The only mention of a threat, right-wing extremists, people in our own midst.
Yes, indeed. And that would probably be, in their eyes, you and me, among others. Congressman, we are patriots. We love this country. We want it to continue to prosper. And if that makes us enemies of the Biden team, so be it. But it makes us, I think, hopefully, the sorts of people who can, with confidence, be listened to and hopefully followed by the American people in this very challenging time. We appreciate so much your leadership, as always, and I especially want to thank you for what you do these days with the Center for Security Policy as its advisory board chairman. Come back to us soon with that.
It's great to have you as a partner.
Thank you, my friend. It is as well.
Hey, thank you.
We'll talk next with Todd Bensman about border security and more. Straight ahead. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tucker Carlson reported last night that a growing number of U.S. military personnel are joining others across the country and refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Such objections may be the beginning in earnest of not only opposition to Joe Biden's increasingly totalitarian vax mandates and the identity papers or passports they inevitably necessitate. Those willing to lose their commissions or jobs rather than take the jab may just be the leading edge of resistance at last to the larger Biden-Harris agenda of fundamentally transforming America. Thus far, the resistance is and must remain peaceful. And if we are lucky, the Navy SEALs, healthcare workers, and other employees and businesses around the country just saying no to Biden's mandates may help spare the rest of us and America the terrifying consequences of the Marxist revolution his team now has well underway. This is Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this day, September 21st, 1924, America's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, addressed the Holy Name Society in Washington, D.C. He stated, "The worst evil that could be inflicted upon the youth would be to leave them at the mercy of their own uncontrolled inclinations. Under such conditions, education would be impossible and all orderly development hopeless. I do not need to picture the result. President Coolidge concluded, "It seems perfectly plain that the right to equality, liberty, and property have for their foundation reverence for God. If we could imagine that swept away, our American government could not long survive."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Todd Bensman. He is, among other things, a senior national security fellow with an absolutely indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. Brings to that job a wealth of experience as an investigative journalist and as a former intelligence officer with the Department of Public Safety in his native state of Texas. He is the author most recently of America's Covert Border War: The Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. Todd is a great friend of this program and truly a national treasure for the reporting that he has been doing now for years, but most especially in the midst of, what we'll be discussing as the Biden effect at the border and what it portends for all of us. Todd Bensman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Frank.
You are doing the Lord's work in going where no drone is allowed to go these days, it seems, under the bridge or in close proximity to it, the international bridge that has become a kind of temporary housing space for thousands upon thousands of mostly Haitian illegal immigrants into the United States. Todd, tell us a little bit about the current state of play with respect to those migrants. Why are they here? And why are they here in such numbers in particular?
Well, there's a simple answer to that and a more complicated one. The simple answer is that these Haitians want to upgrade their lifestyle and economic prospects, just like anyone. None of these Haitians are fleeing earthquakes or presidential assassination in Haiti. I think most of the country is under this false impression that they're here fleeing terrible stuff in Haiti. Almost every one of these Haitians have been living for years in Chile and Brazil in security and relative economic prosperity. No problem for years in those countries. But when they saw the Biden had opened the border, they all figured, well, it's a good time to upgrade from good to maybe great. So that's why that's the simple reason for why they're here. The more complicated reason for this particular encampment, not talking about the broader border, but this particular encampment, so many came at one time because the Biden administration cut a deal with the Mexican government months ago to slow the roll for illegal immigration coming from Guatemala into Mexico. And they asked the Mexicans to keep them in southern Mexico as many as they could through bureaucratic means and the Mexican National Guard. And in doing that, they were requiring that they apply for these different kinds of permissions and travel documents and that sort of thing. And thousands of Haitians built up behind that wall, behind that dam. And then suddenly on September 12th, Sunday, the government of Mexico said, never mind, you can all leave now. And so all of these Haitians are from the Tapachula area, where they had been blocked in this sort of bureaucratic molasses that the Mexicans created. And the Mexicans stabbed Joe Biden in the back
and moved their gathering humanitarian crisis from their southern border to the American southern border. All of these people are from that area.
Now, Todd, let me just ask you, the arrangement that the Biden team fashioned with the Mexican government is not a continuation of the arrangement that the Trump team fashioned with the Mexican government. Tell us about the differences, if you would.
Sure. The big difference is that Trump was a stick kind of guy. He told the Mexicans, hey, listen, we need you to stop immigration at your southern border. And if you don't, we'll do progressive trade tariffs starting small and leading up to 28%. He was very specific about what he was going to do. The Biden administration said, hey, we'll give you money if you just please help us out here. So, you know, when you give somebody money, there's a pretty good chance that they may not follow through until they get more money and more money. And it's not quite the same. And so the Mexican government just said, you know, never mind you. we're going to send this massive wave of Haitians to your border. And that's what they did.
The Haitians coming here had reasonably good lives where they had been temporarily housed. The question that has arisen is, well, can't we just send them back where they came from? And evidently, the Brazilians and the Chileans are not so keen on that idea. Is that right?
Well, no, actually, the administration right now is negotiating with both of those governments right now. And there is a chance because the Biden administration wants to return these Haitians to Brazil and Chile rather than to Haiti. And that's what I'm being told. And so there are negotiations. And so I won't be surprised at all if they do start to repatriate these camp Haitians here in Del Rio only back to Brazil and Chile. Yeah, there is.
That's a change.
Yes, wow. This is new. This is new information.
But they have been flying some of them out, and have they been going back to Haiti, or are they going into the interior of the United States, or are some flying and some are being bused in different directions? What's the current disposition of this camp, Todd?
Well, here's my understanding that I'm being told that the plan is in gestation, and it hasn't quite materialized out yet, but where they want to go is really a very Trumpian, and I like what I'm hearing if they actually do it. I don't like that they wouldn't apply this to the entire border, only to this camp, because it's a political eyesore. But what I'm hearing is that they want to send all single adults to Haiti. And then they want to take the family.
Predominantly male adults, I take it.
No, they're females too. They would move females and male adults to Haiti, a big airlift. And they want to take the family units, and instead of paroling them into the United States like they have with just hundreds of thousands already, they would move those people back to their last country of domicile, which would be Brazil and Chile, once those countries get on board with it. And they may not get on board with it. And then they would allow Central Americans and the other ones to parole into this country. There aren't that many of them.
But there are some in that mix.
Yes, there are some Central Americans, Venezuelans, you know, there's some Africans, and not very many Middle Easterns. Believe me, I've been looking. so I haven't seen too many of them. But if they do this, and they already are flying some of the Haitians back to Haiti. And the day before yesterday, I was in the on the Mexican side in the Acuna bus station, where I saw Haitians filling the station and waiting in line at the ticket counter to buy bus tickets back to southern Mexico, because the disincentive, the deterrent effect of repatriation to Haiti is so abhorrent to these people that they are leaving and fleeing this camp and voluntarily. They don't even want to risk the possibility of being sent back to Haiti. And what they're telling me is that when they do go back to Mexico, they're going to just wait till this repatriation flight mania passes and then they'll try it again.
Todd, I want to come back to the policy issues here in a minute. But first of all, let me just say how much I appreciate, you know, the fact that you're on the ground there and on both sides of the border. This is hazardous duty, to say the least. And I wanted to explore with you some of the dangers that are associated with it. There are, I presume, as with everybody else who's getting to our southern border, cartels in the mix with these folks, that there are, you know, drug and human traffickers that are preying upon them as well, and that there are serious issues concerning health conditions among these populations. Walk us through those sorts of issues and whether they're particularly evident here or just typical of what's coming across that southern border, if not Haitians or other Central Americans, the vast, you know, influx that's coming from all over the world at this point.
Okay, yeah, right. So, you know, let me just start by saying that along the Texas-Mexico border and Arizona and everywhere else too, the threat level is not consistent. It's different in different places. The reason why all of these Haitians and immigrants showed up in Del Rio of all places is because the Mexican area, the area of the Mexican side of the border in this region, Piedras Negras and Acuna, there are cartels there that are operating, but they are not involved in human smuggling. They don't require the peso in that area. And so it's regarded as cheaper and safer. And the migrants all talk. I never met a migrant that didn't have a cell phone with full access to social media, but that's a live wire intelligence dissemination system as well. And the immigrants all know that Del Rio, you can cross yourself over and at will, and that there is no requirement to pay the peso, the tax, nor is there retribution or retaliation. In other words, it's pretty trouble-free in this one area, so they all come here. And I'm a little bit surprised about that, but they haven't seen an opportunity to make a ton of money in Del Rio, but they haven't. I reported on this first back in March of this year that they were starting to come to Del Rio because word got out that the cartels aren't charging $5,000 to cross.
So this explains the concentration for the Haitians in particular. But talk us through what is taking place elsewhere along the border, Todd, and what Border Patrol, for example, are confronting in terms of these numbers that are coming in, accompanied and unaccompanied individuals, children trafficking, and all the rest of it.
Yeah, so a couple hundred miles to the south in the RGV, what they call the RGV sector, Rio Grande Valley sector, you have extremely vicious cartels, Gulf Cartel, CDN, all of these organized crime groups, very, very heavily armed. And no problem at all, just slaughtering people left and right, causing a terrible human toll on immigrants and charging them, you know, thousands of dollars each to get across, to the extent that they have an inventory control system where they put numbered tags on every immigrant's wrist to demark whether they paid and which group was supposed to handle them and all of that. It's very, very well organized, and they're making billions of dollars off of this industry down there.
Billions, you say? B as in boy,
yes.
Billions.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, if you've got 200,000 a month trying to cross, and most of them do try to cross down there, not Del Rio, then, you know, it adds up, you know, after 6 months of a million and a half people paying $5,000 each, plus all the ones that we don't catch. And there are a lot of those that we don't catch at all. They're just being fabulously enriched. And they, you know, there are single, you know, females that are crossing who are raped and kidnapped, and there's extortion rackets and, you know, every kind of, you know, evil that you can think of going on that side of the border, which, you know, explains why these people came over here to Del Rio. You know.
And Todd Bensman, when you talk about this human trafficking business, is it accurate to describe what is going on in at least many cases as kind of indentured servitude, that once they get here, some of these people who don't have thousands of dollars are going to wind up spending maybe years paying the cartels back and doing so at horrific personal expense?
You know, I have seen a lot of reporting about that and claims about that. I don't personally have any. I've never met an immigrant who was describing that. It does seem like you know, they have to pay in advance. They have to. I mean, cartels want cash.
They're not taking credit.
Yeah, they don't take credit that I know of. But I mean, I have heard of that, but I really can't speak to the extortion part of it. You know, the debt servitude part of it.
But there certainly are many, many examples of people being essentially sold into sex trafficking operations.
Beyond,
many of them
beyond
children,
question.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, beyond question. A lot of that happens on the Mexican side, where, you know, young women disappear and, you know, it's often kidnapping based. And, the extortion rackets also, you know, if you don't pay the cartels up front, you know, they'll hold you and contact the families and say, hey, we'll start sending fingers back if you don't find the money, kind of thing.
Todd, this is a human tragedy on such a vast scale. Let me come now to the policies that have put this in motion. We talked a little bit about, you know, the differences between the Trump and the Biden approach, specifically to Mexico. But just talk more generally about what were the circumstances when Biden took office and how have they been transformed, one might say fundamentally transformed, by the Biden team in just the space of the past, whatever it is now, 9 months.
Well, the story of these Haitians really is a very illustrative for the answer to that question. You know, I've interviewed just dozens and dozens and dozens over the last year, Haitians. They're very common. And, you know, the reason why a lot of them have been living for years in Brazil and Chile is because they realized that under the Trump administration, that they would not be able to get over the border with a high degree of confidence and a high percentage of a chance to get over the border, that under the wait in Mexico policy, they would be returned to apply for asylum inside Mexico. Nobody wants to do that. They want to apply inside the United States because nobody's eligible for asylum. They're eligible to apply, but they'll never get it. But they'll be illegal inside the country. So the wait in Mexico was they didn't even want to bother. They just stayed in Chile and Brazil. And then the pandemic, Title 42, and Trump was doing repatriation flights to Haiti and to Guatemala. There was the first, if they wanted to apply for asylum and they passed through Guatemala, we would send them to Guatemala and say, you have to apply in Guatemala because we've deemed it a safe. So the bottom line is that there was this deterrence. Why is it a deterrent? Because all of these people have to pay thousands of dollars in smuggling fees to get here. And if your chances of actually succeeding and getting a payoff on your investment is, you know, 10%, you're not going to do it. If it's 90%, you're going to do it. And so under Biden, Biden policies increased that to 90%, maybe even 100% if you were a family, part of a family. They were letting family units in, and so they paid the money, they invested, and were rewarded on that investment. And so the policies that Biden put in place or did was he reversed all of the Trump deterrents, got rid of them, eschewed them, criticized them as cruel, and decided that the only non-cruel kind of policy to have would be to let people in. That's their idea of kindliness. And so they ended deportation inside the interior. And that was just wonderful, because even if you got let in and you didn't get your asylum, you were forever inside the country, you know, because there's nobody's going to deport you. And it was just a perfect storm for immigrants all over the world, that if you could get in, you would never be deported. You would be able to apply for asylum and lose and still not get deported. And that's what's been happening. That's why we have 1.5 million just in the 1 year. In another month, we're probably going to be in numbers that are the highest in American history.
Truly an invasion, I think it's fair to say. And Todd, one of the things that we value so much about your work at the Center for Immigration Studies is that you do bring a national security background to all of this. You've been in the law enforcement business for a time. You've seen up close and personal, as they say, both in that role and in your current one at the Center for Immigration Studies, the nature of the people who are coming across. And while I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of them may meet the profile that you just described of people seeking to better themselves economically and perhaps the safety of their families and so on, there are some in that mix who are coming here who wish us ill. And obviously we've been talking about this with you in recent days about, you know, the lack of vetting of Afghans that are being brought in here in vast numbers. But that's true in spades with this much, much larger influx of people, many of whom we don't know their identity for sure and the like. Just give us quickly, if you would, Todd, a professional assessment of the extent to which all of this conduces to real threats to the homeland and even national security of the United States.
Right. Well, as we've talked about before, there are immigrants, people moving, traveling from the Middle East, from countries like Syria and Pakistan and, frankly, Afghanistan, not a lot, but there are routes that lead directly from countries that are riven with, institutionally riven, meaning, you know, schools and government and, you know, neighborhood mosques in the countryside, with Islamist extremist ideology. And those are people who are showing up at the border as well, right alongside Haitians and Angolans and everybody else. I mean, I've met them. I've interviewed them. A couple months ago, I was in Costa Rica on that trail and met immigrants from the Islamic Republic of Mauritania and Senegal. And I've met Pakistanis on the route and Iraqis and Iranians, personally met them and interviewed them. Bangladeshis. And that's obviously, anybody should need convincing, but, you know, people apparently do. That's obviously a national security problem when you don't know who they are. They show up without identification. I was just listening to Lindsey Graham a few minutes ago before you called on Fox News talking about this very thing, that when the border is under this kind of collapsing stress, which it is collapsing, there are Border Patrol agents from all up and down the line here in Del Rio working on guard duty and processing, and they are not on the line.
No,
the line is empty. Yeah. The line is empty. I'm telling you, there is nobody out there right now. Nobody is guarding the line. And you can walk across and get right into the country.
And the number of getaways, therefore, are presumably substantially higher as a result as well. Todd Bensman, absolutely. We have to leave it at this for the moment. Thank you for this comprehensive report, as well as the incredible on-the-ground, you know, coverage of this story that you are providing all of us. It really is a huge national service, and it's deeply appreciated, I know, by our listeners and sure by those on the various other programs that you're participating in. So come back to us with updates, if you would, very soon.
Yeah,
I hope
thanks.
The rest of you
I appreciate
will
it.
Come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tucker Carlson reported last night that a growing number of U.S. military personnel are joining others across the country and refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Such objections may be the beginning in earnest of not only opposition to Joe Biden's increasingly totalitarian vax mandates and the identity papers or passports they inevitably necessitate. Those willing to lose their commissions or jobs rather than take the jab may just be the leading edge of resistance at last to the larger Biden-Harris agenda of fundamentally transforming America. Thus far, the resistance is and must remain peaceful. And if we are lucky, the Navy SEALs, healthcare workers, and other employees and businesses around the country just saying no to Biden's mandates may help spare the rest of us and America the terrifying consequences of the Marxist revolution his team now has well underway. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this day, September 21st, 1924, America's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, addressed the Holy Name Society in Washington, D.C. He stated, "The worst evil that could be inflicted upon the youth would be to leave them at the mercy of their own uncontrolled inclinations. Under such conditions, education would be impossible and all orderly development hopeless. I do not need to picture the result." President Coolidge concluded, "It seems perfectly plain that the right to equality, liberty, and property have for their foundation reverence for God. If we could imagine that swept away, our American government could not long survive."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.